Moses led them out of Egyptian bondage. He told them that if you worship idols, here's what God will do to you. Where do I read that? What I'd like to do is just very hurriedly go through these passages. These are familiar to you. Deuteronomy where? 4:25. Deuteronomy 4:25. The next one, Deuteronomy chapter 8. The next, Deuteronomy 28 through 30. Specifically, Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 through 10. I want you to remember those three in particular. Okay? Deuteronomy 4, Deuteronomy 8, Deuteronomy 28 through 30. Okay? Then I want you to remember Deuteronomy chapter 34. Deuteronomy chapter 34, not very long, but it's where God takes Moses upon Mount Nebo and shows him the land. The significance of the passage is the land that I swore unto thy fathers to give them. Deuteronomy chapter 34. Right, he sees it and he dies and is buried by the hand of the Lord on Mount Nebo. Moving then from Deuteronomy, we come to Joshua chapter 1. In Joshua chapter 1, verse 6. Joshua is to lead them into the promised land. In Joshua chapter 3 through Joshua chapter 11, what's the subject matter being discussed? Joshua chapter 3 and 4, they are the conquering of the land. 3 and 4, they're coming across the Jordan River. When you come to chapter 6, the conquering city of Jericho, Ai, chapter 7, review, chapter 8, and so forth. And then when you come to chapter 11, the last couple of verses, Joshua has affirmed that he has completed the conquering of the land. Then the next major passage I want you to put in your list to remember is Joshua chapter 21, beginning in verse 43. Joshua chapter 21, verse 43, where Joshua again reminds them that they have conquered the land. God gave it to them, all the land which he sware to their fathers. They possessed it, and they dwelt in it, and not one thing failed. The next one I want you to remember is Joshua chapter 23. Joshua chapter 23, verses 14 through 16. Joshua chapter 23, verses 14 through 16. Two thoughts in that I want us to see. Again, number one, Joshua says that not one thing has failed. God gave you all the land which he promised to give you.
The second thing is that if you worship and serve other gods, just as Moses told them in Deuteronomy 4 and Deuteronomy 8 and Deuteronomy chapter 30, 28 through 30, then he will destroy you from off this good land. So here we see the threat of God renewed unto them. Now, that's the book of Joshua, and when you come to the last chapter, chapter 24, the challenge, choose you this day whom you will serve, and their affirmation will be faithful to God. Now, the book of Judges. In the book of Judges, in the second chapter, verse 10, in your list to remember, Judges chapter 2, verse 10. What happens? New generation. And what do? All right, they begin to worship idols. They forget all about the mighty works of God, and they begin to worship idols. And that's what the book of Judges is about. The circle, as we saw, that typifies the 300-year period, and a cycle of 15 judges during this time. A faithfulness to the Lord, idolatry, oppression, deliverance, and around the horn they go. And so we want to be familiar with the book of Judges from this chart. Now, all of these that are listed on this chart, they're all in your lesson book. You can go through the book of Judges, and I would encourage you very much so to make note of these judges in particular, but also make note as you study through the book of Judges, the expression as it occurs over and over and over, the children of Israel did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah and forgot Jehovah their God and served the Balaam and the Asherah, as you see that occur time and time again. Now, this being the list of the judges, and why didn't you tell me that I didn't have that up there? Let's do it that way. Is that more better, Richard?
Oh, yeah.
As you say, more better?
Okay.
That just is lots better. You can see that. I'm sorry for not having that up there. We want to talk a little bit about Abimelech. I think that's about where we left off in our last study. We want to pick up and talk about Jephthah. But one more note on Abimelech. What makes Abimelech different from the rest of the judges? He was self-appointed, and he really wasn't a deliverer. There really wasn't an oppressor except Abimelech that smote these people. Yes, Randy?
I'm not really sure why he's part of the list.
Okay.
He's appointed by God.
All right.
And he's not really a judge.
No, he's really not. And why he's on the list, I really can't tell you. But typically, you read the list of the judges, you find his name.
He didn't even call himself a judge, he called himself a king.
Called himself a king, a self-appointed king. And, of course, that created all kinds of problems. Now, this is on the heels of what judge?
Gideon.
When we talk about Gideon, Gideon delivered the children of Israel from whom? The Amalekites, and in particular the Midianites. The Midianites and the Amalekites. Now, when we look at Gideon, Gideon had how many children? 71 children. All right, 70 children by multiple wives, but Abimelech was by a concubine. All right, and when Abimelech asserted himself to be king, what did he do with those who were sons, legitimate, thank you, I was looking for a term, legitimate sons of Gideon? What did he do with them? Killed them all but one. And what was the one that was spared? What was his name? Jotham, or Jotham. All right. And Jotham told a parable, as it were, a fable, as some have called it. What was the fable and what was its significance? This is still in Judges chapter 9. What was this fable? The trees want a king. And so they go to what tree first? All right, they go to the olive tree. And they ask the olive tree to be king over them. Well, the olive tree, a very notable tree, can't leave the responsibility that it has to be king over the trees. So doesn't become their king. Then goes to the fig tree. Fig tree, very prominent tree, can't leave its responsibility, does not desire to be king over them. Then, of course, goes to the vine. And the vine, very prominent, can't leave its responsibility to be king over the trees. And so then who do the trees go to be their king? The bramble, all right? The thistles, the tumbleweeds, all right? And we see the problems involved with that. You've gone from the top of the food chain down to the bottom of the food chain, so to speak. And does the bramble desire to be their king? Yes, but if you will do what? That's key to the fable. Take refuge in my shade. Now, if you take refuge in my shade, that means you do what I tell you to do. All right. Now, that was the agreement that the people make with Abimelech, isn't it? They desire to have a king. And Abimelech asserts himself to be their king. We're looking in Judges chapter 9 regarding the... we hesitate to call him judge, but he asserted himself to be king over the people of Israel. And then what happened to Abimelech? Time passes, and it appears that he's a very successful king. There was a man by the name of Gaal who desired to lead the citizens of Shechem to depose Abimelech from being their king. And what did Abimelech do? you want a king, this is what's going to be. What did Abimelech do? Well, let me just ask very simply. Who was victor, Gaal or Abimelech? Abimelech was. He killed Gaal. And Gaal's assertion was, if I was the leader of this people, then I would remove Abimelech. And he said to Abimelech in verse 29, increase thine army and come out. Come fight me. Well, he did. And Gaal was defeated. So his bold boast didn't get him anywhere except dead. And then, of course, we know that Abimelech took stock in what he did. He defeated the inhabitants of the city of Shechem. There were some who thought that they could escape as they would go up into the tower of Shechem. Now, draw me a picture here. John Gregowski, if you would, please. The city-states that were characteristic of the land that we're talking about, they provided for themselves protection by building a wall around them. Now, what did they frequently do from place to place in the walls?
They would build houses in the walls.
All right, they'd build houses in or on the walls, and occasionally you would find a tower. And you can see why. When you look at fortresses today, you see that there's a place over here that's built up really high to provide protection for those inside the walls. Well, these inhabitants of Shechem thought they would find protection in the tower of Shechem. And what was it that Abimelech did? He set it on fire. And what happened to all those folks that were inside? They all died. That's right. So he came to the next city. And they thought that they would find protection in their tower, in Thebes, it tells us. And what did Abimelech do to their city? What did he seek to do to their city? All right, he sought to set that on fire. But a woman that was up on the roof of the tower, what did she do? She dropped a millstone. Now, I want to suggest to you that she didn't just accidentally let go of it. She dropped it on his head. And the text tells us that it cracked his skull. And rather than for the saying to go abroad that a woman has killed me, he ordered his armor bearer to take his sword and thrust him through and to kill him so that it would be said that he had been killed in this engagement rather than to be killed by a woman. You can read that in the latter few verses there, verse 10. And so that was the end of Abimelech. But that's not just a story. That was the fulfillment of the prophecy of Jotham. Jotham said he'll die. And in this fable that he told, that's how he died. He was killed in this way. So that's Abimelech. And Randy, you've got a legitimate question. Why is he in the list of the judges? I can't answer that, but generally he's considered as a part of the list of the judges. Then we go and discuss some of these other judges, Taylor and Jair. But I want to talk with you tonight, or this morning, about Jephthah. Jephthah. We sometimes don't talk too much about Jephthah, and perhaps for a number of reasons. Let me pass through all this. We've talked about that already. Well, Jephthah.
But,
sir.
Just thinking of the Abimelech thing.
Yes?
The prophecy, or you could call it a prophecy of Jotham. That was really a curse on the people of Israel for allowing themselves to be ruled by Abimelech.
That is correct.
And then ultimately, I know he slew his brothers, his half-brothers.
Yes?
70 of them. And somehow that made him seem powerful to everybody. They said, yeah, let's follow him. But that was foolish. They could have easily just taken him and killed him.
Yeah.
I say easily. I don't know if he had an army of men that supported him or what.
It appears that he did.
Yeah.
But
I just mean they allowed themselves to be ruled by him.
Well, that's right. And of course, there's an element that needs to be considered in that when we make an application of that principle to the New Testament. When you come to 3 John, for example, and we read about Diotrephes, who loved to have the preeminence of men, and those who would receive John, the Apostle John, and those who were traveling with him, Diotrephes would cast them out of the church. And we look at that and we say, well, how did Diotrephes ever get to have a place like that in the church? People let him. They allowed that to happen. And that was wrong on their part. Diotrephes is not the only one at fault. And neither is Abimelech here the only one at fault for these circumstances to exist. But when we talk about in our lesson book, it's lesson number 20 in your lesson book, the latter, Judges, that's on page number 80 if you have your lesson book or access to one. We read of a new wave of oppression that begins because the Israelites, again, are worshiping the gods of the land that they dwell in. Now, in Judges chapter 10 is where I want to pick up this thought just before Jephthah. Judges chapter 10, look if you will please at verse 6. Judges chapter 10, verse 6. It says, and the children of Israel again did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, and served the Baalim and the Asherah and the gods of Syria and the gods of Sidon and the gods of Moab and the gods of the children of Ammon and the gods of the Philistines, and they forsook Jehovah and served him not. Now what did God allow to happen because of that? Verse 7. Sold them into the hand of the Philistines. Now this is the pattern that we've seen throughout the days of the judges. When they worshipped and served idols, God delivered them into the hands of an oppressor. And that's what Moses told them would happen. Deuteronomy where? 4, 8, 28 through 30. And Joshua told them in Joshua chapter 23, verses 14 through 16. So this is not something that should be news to them. But it appears to be news for each generation, doesn't it? We've got some problems with that. They've not learned the lesson. And so they began to worship the gods of the land, and God delivered them into the oppression of the peoples of the land. In this case, the Philistines and the Ammonites. And they began to cry unto God. And I want you to look, if you will, in verse 11, beginning of chapter 10. Judges chapter 10, verse 11. Terry, you mind to do some reading for me, beginning in verse 11 down through verse 16, please?
Judges 10, 11
through
16.
Yes.
And Jehovah said unto the children of Israel, did not I save you from the Egyptians and from the Amorites and from the children of Ammon? From the Philistines, the Sidonians also, and the Amalekites, and the Manites, did oppress you, and ye cried unto me, and I saved you out of their hand. Yet ye have forsaken me, and served other gods. Wherefore I will save you no more. Go and cry unto the gods which ye have chosen. Let them save you in the time of your distress. And the children of Israel said unto Jehovah, we have sinned. Do thou unto us whatsoever seemeth good unto thee, only deliver us, we pray thee, this day. And they put away the foreign gods from among them, and served Jehovah. And his soul was grieved for the misery of Israel.
Well, I want you to notice, in the previous two judges, Tola and Jair, it tells us in verse 2 that Tola judged Israel 20 and 3 years, and Jair 20 and 2 years. And he died and was buried. Here we've got a time frame that passes. What is it that sometimes we do over a period of time? We forget, don't we? And as time has passed, they've forgotten. They've forgotten all about God, and they're immersed in this idolatrous society, and they're worshiping the idols of the people in whose land they live. And when things get really bad, who do they turn to? They turn to God. And God reminds them. I want you to look at the time frame Go back, if you will, to verse 11 once again. Did I not save you from the Egyptians and from the Amorites and from the children of Ammon and from the Philistines, the Sidonians also and the Amalekites and the Maonites did oppress you? I saved you from all of these people. Notice it goes back to the days of Egypt, when the people were growing and developing down there in the time of Joseph, and they grew in number so large that another Pharaoh, after the Pharaoh that knew Joseph, when he came on the scene, what did he do to them? He made slaves out of them, you recall. And Moses was sent to deliver them. Now, in this brief statement, when God said, I delivered you or saved you from the Egyptians, well, what did he do? You remember the plagues? All of those? You remember the crossing of the Red Sea? The provisions in the wilderness? God said, I did all that. I saved you from the Egyptians. Now, what about these people in whose land you dwell? During the days of Joshua, what did I do? I gave you their land. Gave it to you. I did all that. And now over the years, what is it that you've done? Repeatedly, you've worshipped the gods of the land. Now you come to me in times of trouble and you want help. You know who can help you? Go to the gods of the land. Go to those folks you've been worshipping over there. Those idols, you know, that have mouths that can't say anything, feet can't do anything, go anywhere, hands can't do anything. You go ask them. They're the people, or they're the gods you've been serving. Go ask them for help.
Randy? Kind of a generic question, but when it says in verse 10, the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord, saying, we've sinned against you. Indeed, we have forsaken our God and served the Baals. The Lord said to the sons of Israel, did I not deliver you? No, I'm wrong. It's not specified. Was God speaking to a prophet who then turned and told the people that? It says he spoke to the sons of Israel.
Yeah.
And it's just curious to me, and the reason I'm wondering is because as we're studying this, it came to my mind, I thought, well, how would the sons of Israel, they were talking about another generation, the next generation, the only way they could forget or not know is because they weren't taught.
Yeah.
The generation who knew about it didn't teach them about it. Or they talked about it, they didn't believe it, because they could go either way. But at the same time, what did they have to study? Was the first five books written at this point? Moses obviously wrote the first five books. He's dead now, so they must have the law. It's written. And I guess we can assume then that it was copied and given to all the tribes as they went out and occupied this territory.
All I know, to answer that would be Hebrews 1:1-2. And I just camp there. Because it tells us that God in time past spoke unto the fathers in divers portions and in divers manners, different means and different amounts. But he hath in these last days spoken unto us in his Son, or through his Son. Now, when we look throughout Old Testament history, even before the giving of the law of Moses as such, we see God communicating unto man through different means. How he communicated, this question came up, I think, perhaps Wednesday night, about how did God appoint these men as judges? How did they know that they had this role? Well, in the case of Gideon, an angel told him. Well, was that the case of all of them? I don't know. How God communicated that to these people, we're not told in every instance. Some instances, we are. Some it was through a prophet, some it was through an angel. But we do know from Hebrews 1, it was through different means and different amounts. But the point being, he did communicate to them. And he's always held man accountable to his law. He communicated it to them. So when we come to this period and say, well, you're worshiping these idols, somebody's dropped the ball. Either they've not learned the lessons or their fathers have not taught them the lessons.
So we can assume when it says the Lord said to the sons of Israel, basically he's chewing them out for not believing.
That's correct.
But we can assume then that whoever he was speaking to was then spreading the word that this is what the Lord spoke.
Somebody's dropped the ball, yeah. And now he's communicating to them somehow, through some means. He's telling them, this is your responsibility. You should have known this, but you don't. Now, you think these idols can deliver you, go talk to them. Now, I find it interesting that that's what it took to bring them around. Verse 15 says, we have sinned. Do thou unto us whatsoever seemeth good to thee, only deliver us, we pray thee, this day. Their plight is so horrible at the hands of their enemies. The text tells us that God was grieved for the misery of Israel. He had compassion for them. Now, did they bring it on themselves? Yes. And here's consequences. It took years for them to get to this point, but God has compassion upon them because of the things that they're suffering. Does that mean then that the suffering is just going to be taken away? No. No. But He reminds them of what He's done for them over the generations, all the way back to Egypt, and how they have repeatedly worshipped idols. Now, here's where you are. Now, that brings us to Jephthah in chapter 11. And I want to talk with you about Jephthah just a little bit. When we talk about Jephthah and Samson, our writer of our lesson book tells us that these two events, it's likely that they overlapped in time. Now, one of the things that we've noted about this 300-year period of time is we don't always have something horrible going on. We don't always have a period of war and a period of deliverance or oppression. Sometimes there were years of peace. Sometimes there were times of oppression that overlapped in the north and in the south.
So can we say that the Levites are all wiped out at this time?
No, I wouldn't say the Levites are all wiped out at this time, because if the Levites were all wiped out, then we would not have the period of the building of the temple, the function of the Levites in the temple, and so forth, and so on. We wouldn't have the Levites appointed according to their genealogies during the times of the restoration days of Nehemiah and Ezra. But what we do have is whoever was supposed to be teaching them not doing that. As far as sacrifice unto God is concerned, not doing that. Now let us underscore in our thinking that God has always had a remnant. We're not reading about that here. We're reading about what the general populace did and the consequences that were imposed upon them. Now, even when we think about God's remnant, which is not the purpose of the book of Judges to tell us about the remnant, but even when we read about a remnant who was faithful to God, we see that often that remnant suffered right along with those who were idolatrous. They suffered consequences too. They weren't spared just because they were faithful to God. Case in point, we've been studying about Daniel and Ezekiel and some of these who were prophets during the days of the captivity. They were taken captive too. Oh, yes, the children of Israel. Yes, I think we could justly say that. Yeah. All right. Well, again, these pagan gods, Baal, typically used to identify in a generic way the patron god of various cities, but here used to describe the god of fertility for crops and livestock, and of course, Asherah or Asherah, likewise a goddess of fertility, and we will study more about that in some detail when we get to 1 Kings, as we talk about Solomon and his worshiping the gods and goddesses of the various women that he had married and taken as concubines. But these Ammonites, their location is important, and of course we'll get into the discussion of Jephthah in great detail when we get to the chart on that. But I want you to see where they are. Ammon and Moab, tell me who they are. Who are the Ammonites?
Right?
I am. Who are the Ammonites?
Ammonites and Moabites were the sons of Lot.
Yeah.
It was the Lot and his daughters.
All right. The incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughters. Ammon and Moab were born. And, of course, these daughters were concerned that the seed would not continue. So they go in unto their father, getting drunk, go into him. And they have a son apiece. Ammon is one of them. The Moabites developed then from the other. And what was the relationship between the Ammonites and the Moabites? Pardon me? And the Israelites. That's right. They were enemies. Enemies of the Israelites. But you see, they're relatives. The Israelites descended from Abraham. And the Moabites and the Ammonites descended from Lot, who was Abraham's nephew. All right, so we've got relatives, you see, that develop into nations of people that hate each other. And they have a relationship that's not so very good. Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh were involved in this oppression. And you can see why they're right in the middle of it. Here's the Ammonites and the Ammonites and the Moabites. And they're trying to come in and take the land from the people of God. Now, when, on the pass beyond that, when Jephthah is called upon to help the Israelites, there's not a real good relationship between Jephthah and the Israelites generally. Why?
He wasn't part of the main family. They kicked him out of the territory.
All right. All right, look over here where he was. He was over here in the land of what was known as the land of Gilead. He was a Gileadite, and he was the son of a prostitute, the son of a harlot. And so he wasn't favored very much by the Israelites. If you look at the text, verse 1, Judges chapter 11, verse 1, "Now Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of a harlot, and Gilead begat Jephthah. And Gilead's wife bare him sons. And when his wife's sons grew up, they drove out Jephthah and said unto him, Thou shalt not inherit in our father's house, for thou art the son of another woman. Then Jephthah fled from his brethren and dwelt in the land of Tob, and there were gathered vain fellows unto Jephthah, and they went out with him." Now, Jephthah, because of the circumstances that he was in, no doubt, became a mighty man of valor. And he had to kind of, I guess, be strong because he didn't have anybody much on his side. Now, that's assumption on my part. But if you'll notice in verse 4, "It came to pass after a while that the children of Ammon made war against Israel. And it was so that when the children of Ammon made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to fetch Jephthah out of the land of Tob. And they said unto Jephthah, Come and be our chief, that we may fight with the children of Ammon." You know, if somebody has some talents and abilities that you recognize as advantageous to you, sometimes your memory begins to lapse. You don't remember all the ugly things you've said about them. You don't remember all the ways that you've treated them. You just see how they can help you. And so you go and want to make peace. But look at the text. It says in verse 7, "And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, Did ye not hate me and drive me out of my father's house? And why are ye come unto me now when ye are in distress?" Well, that's what they've been doing with God, isn't it? And now here they're going to treat Jephthah that way. In verse 8, "The elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, Therefore we have turned again to thee now, that thou mayest go with us and fight with the children of Ammon, and thou shalt be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, If ye bring me home again to the fight, or to fight with the children of Ammon, and Jehovah deliver them before me, shall I be your head." You see his question? Are you just going to use me and throw me away? I have certain talents and abilities as a military man to deliver you from the oppression of the Ammonites. Now what happens when the battle is over? Am I still going to be your head? And in verse 10, the elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, Jehovah shall be witness between us. Surely according to thy word, so will we do. Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and chief over them. And Jephthah spake all his words before Jehovah in Mizpah. Now question, does God bless Jephthah? Yeah, you said that very cautiously. Very good. In some ways, yes, he does. I want to call your attention to what Jephthah does. You know, sometimes when there's a disagreement, it's not always the very first option to fight. What does Jephthah first do?
He makes more of
Okay. All right, let's back up just a bit. What's he do, Jenny? He tries to reason with the king of the Ammonites. Tries to reason with him. Well, what's his reasoning? First of all, why are you upset with the Israelites? He writes him a letter. Why are you upset with the Israelites? And the king of the Ammonites replies. What's his reply? Why is he upset with the Israelites, Lynn?
Because he says that when they were traveling up to come into the land, that they stole things and they took over his stuff.
Yeah.
And he wants it back.
That's right. You took my land. And I want all that back. Well, notice how that Jephthah replies in verse 15 of Judges chapter 11. He said unto him, thus saith Jephthah, Israel took not away the land of Moab, nor the land of the children of Ammon. Look at our map here. Jephthah said, no, we didn't take your land. And we didn't take Moab's land. Why?
God told them not to.
You go back to Deuteronomy chapter 9. I'm sorry, chapter 2, verse 9, verse 18, and verse 19. God said, these people are your relatives. You don't go in and destroy the Moabites and the Ammonites. You don't take theirs. Well, why is the king of Ammon so upset then? Why does he say, yes, you did?
Because they didn't.
Why?
Because Ammon fought against. They took the land away from
them. That's right. Let's read on. In verse 18 of chapter 11, it says, and they went through the wilderness and went around the land of Edom and the land of Moab and came by the east side of the land of Moab, and they encamped on the other side of the Arnon, but they came not within the border of Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab. And Israel sent messengers unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, the king of Heshbon. And Israel said unto him, let us pass, we pray thee, through thy land into my place. But Sihon trusted not Israel, and what he did? All right, he attacked them. And what then did Joshua do? He attacked back. And so he defeated the Amorites, as God said. Now in verse 23, pick up the reading. It says, so now Jehovah, the God of Israel, hath deposed the Amorites from before his people Israel, and shouldest thou possess them? Wilt not thou possess that which Chemosh, thy God, giveth thee to possess? And whomsoever Jehovah our God hath dispossessed from before us, them will we possess. And now, art thou anything better than Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever strive against Israel? Did he ever fight against them? Now, Japheth is making some very legitimate arguments. God gave us this land. We went around you. And so we didn't just take your land. But those who fought against us, we fought back. Simple point, isn't it? And so, now what's your point? You see, Mr. King of Ammon, you're in trouble because of decisions that you made, not because of what we did to you. Now, having said all of that, what does Mr. King of Ammon want to do? He wants to fight. And what then does Japheth do?
I'm laughing because you keep calling him different names. Jephthah, you called him Joshua, you called him...
Well, I called him Joshua a while ago because it was during the days when Joshua was leading these people in that they had an encounter. But now they've got an encounter here with Jephthah. I may have. You just never know. This fellow that we're talking about here in the 11th chapter, what did he do?
He made a vow with God.
All right. What was his vow?
Well, it was stupid.
Well, besides that, what was it?
Honestly, I've never been able to understand why he made this vow. I'm trying to see what verse it said. He said, verse 30, Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. That was his vow to the Lord.
That was kind of stupid, wasn't it?
Yeah. Plain stupid.
That just wasn't the brightest thing that the man ever did. But while all this stuff with Ammon is going on, we've still got some folks over here that are unhappy. The Philistines, and that's where they enter into the picture.
I was going to say that just before you go on to that, in chapter 11 here, starting at verse 12, we have a discussion with the Ammonites, but in verse 19, 20, whatever, 21, it's the Amorites.
Okay.
So I think the Ammonites, who always lived there on the east side of Gad, and the Amorites were the ones that lived where Gad is now.
Yeah, the Amorites...
We're down here.
Originally. And, of course, then you've got the Ammonites on this east side of what we call the Transjordan, but the higher elevation of it. They're over into the desert area of it. So they look over here to the west side, and they see the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh and so forth, and they see all this wonderful... grazing land, and so you've got a gouge there that they're not happy with. They want that. So it's almost like any excuse will do. We're going to fight. But Jephthah, when we talk about Jephthah and this vow, foolish thing that he promised to do. If you'll deliver them into my hand, I will offer the very first thing that comes out of my house as a sacrifice, a burnt offering. I'm going to throw this up here just to make a comment, and then I'm going to pass on beyond it, which I always get in trouble when I do that. But just to make the comment, when we look at this map, this is a map of the traditional route of the children of Israel coming in to the promised land. Here we see them passing through a portion of Edom, going essentially around Moab, and here's the Arnon River, and then they did not pass through the Ammonites or the Moabites. They passed around, just like what we read here in this text. This is what Jephthah said we did. And if you look at this map, that shows an alternate crossing into the wilderness of Shur, as some believe it's here instead of up in this area. But if the crossing was here, you still see the travel going around the Ammonites as they go down the Arnon River and into the Promised Land. So the claim that the king of Ammon has made is not settled. It's just not so. It's not accurate when you consider the travels of the children of Israel into the Promised Land. Now, here's the vow that he made. And, of course, you've got that. I got 5 minutes to talk about that. That'll be about right. When we talk about this vow and the foolishness of it, the question is always asked, well, do you think he did that? Do you think he killed his daughter? And folks go back and forth and back and forth on whether or not Jephthah killed his daughter as a burnt offering unto the Lord. Now, we know, Randy's pointed out, that it's foolish. What he vowed was foolish. We're all in agreement there. We know that in verse 34, it tells us that his daughter came out to meet him, and she was excited because he comes back victorious. And And, of course, his heart is troubled because he knows what he said. And in verse 35, he said, "For I have opened my mouth unto Jehovah, and I cannot go back." And she obviously now is informed about what he has vowed. And she said in verse 37, "Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months that I may depart and go down upon the mountains and bewail my virginity, I and my companions." And he said unto her, "Go," and he sent her away for 2 months, and she departed, she and her companions, and bewailed her virginity upon the mountains. And it came to pass at the end of 2 months that she returned unto her father, who did with her according to his vow, which he had vowed, and she knew not man. And it was a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to celebrate the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite, 4 days in a year. Now folks read that and say, "Well, yeah, he fulfilled his vow. He killed her." I'll just leave that with you and make this comment. The text tells us that he did that according to the vow which he had vowed, and she knew not a man. I'm going to hold my thought. David, go ahead.
Just one word. In, I have King James, verse 40, says to lament the daughter at certain times of the year.
Yeah, well, the idea is that this was a yearly custom or feast. A yearly custom, I should say, to observe what was done on this occasion. Whether he killed her or not, again, I'm going to leave that with you, but I think the thing that we need to emphasize is not the question of whether or not he killed his daughter. That's not the question. The question is the seriousness of a vow. That's the thing that needs to be emphasized here. What he said was foolish. It was just foolish. But saying it's foolish doesn't solve the problem. He should not have vowed. Now, when we turn back in our text to Numbers chapter 30, the Bible has a great deal to say about vows that evidently Jephthah had forgotten. Numbers chapter 30, look at verse 2. Numbers chapter 30, verse 2. There the text tells us, "When a man voweth a vow unto Jehovah, or sweareth an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth. Also, when a woman voweth a vow unto Jehovah and bindeth herself by a bond, being in her father's house in her youth, and her father heareth her vow," and so forth and so on. You see, what's emphasized here is you do what you say you will do. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5, the writer said it's better not to vow than to vow and not do. What you say you will do needs to be binding. You need to see that before you vow. When you make the vow and then say, "Well, you know, that was foolish. It was a mistake. I shouldn't have done that." As if to say it's all right to make foolish vows. No, we need to take our vows seriously. Another point very quickly that I want us to see is that the offering of a human sacrifice unto God was contrary to the law of God. Now, essentially what Japheth has vowed to do, he's vowed to commit something that's sinful. Now, that raises the question whether he followed through with it or not. Another thing that I want you to consider in this is in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 32, in this list of great heroes of faith, you'll find Jephthah's name. So, Jephthah was a man of faith, his name recorded for all history. Now you ask the question, did he offer his daughter as a burnt offering unto the Lord? You see, when we look at this, I think we've got more evidence to consider than just to say he vowed something that was foolish, therefore he killed his daughter. We need to think a little more carefully.
We also have to take into consideration that David was a murderer and he was forgiven.
All right.
So Jephthah could have been a murderer and also forgiven.
Well, yeah, but this would make him a premeditated murderer.
Well, no, what it means is when he made the vow, he didn't know his daughter was going to be the first to come out.
No, I didn't know that.
He might have thought one of his bulls was going to come out to meet him.
Yeah.
That's
where I keep mine.
Yeah.
In the house. All right. But you've got a point. So we'll think about that some more between now and Wednesday.